and our esteemed. Well, I think we're going to go ahead and get started. Thank you for coming to the Center for Collaborative Conservation's seminar series. I'm Kim Skylander. I'm the Associate Director of CCC. Speaker today is David Bartecki. So I will introduce David for you. David received his MA in Cultural Anthropology from Colorado State University. Good job. And serves as Executive Director of Village Earth, a not-for-profit community development organization located in here in Fort Collins. Is anyone familiar with Village Earth? Oh, it's a great place. You should go check it out. He has extensive practical experience in community development, working with grassroots groups and indigenous groups both here in the U.S. and around the world. He's got quite a bit of work he's done with that. He served as a trainer for the International Institute for Sustainable Development at CSU since 1998. And currently teaches several courses in community capacity building and dealing with community development. He also has been an instrumental part of research projects with the CSU's Department of Anthropology, including a 6-year-long longitudinal study of the informal economy of the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. He also has worked with did a survey of farmers and ranchers participating in the National Conservation Reserve Program. And it's done community-based consensus on the Rosebud and Pine Ridge reservations in South Dakota. And David will be speaking today about Village Earth's global affiliate model, an approach to supporting grassroots organizations around the world that he developed through his fellowship with the Center for Collaborative Conservation. So, thank you.
Yeah, I want to thank the CCC for organizing this talk today. But especially for helping fund the development of this model over the last year.
David, you may have to speak up a little just because
the fan. Yeah. But maybe we could, since there's such a small group here, maybe just go around really quick and maybe just say your name and if you're with the department or doing some research or something, just say a little bit about yourself. Bill
Turner, Center of Education.
Gail Marie Kimelon, staff with Village Earth.
I'm Teresa Judd. I'm a political scientist and a third year doctoral student studying the local forest governance.
My name is Jocelyn Guadalupe. And I work with the Center for Water Conservation.
I'm Sophia Lamb, research associate in the Department of Ecosystem Science and Sustainability, and assistant director for the Geospatial Center.
Jim Marbarak, Director of the Center for Protected Area Management.
I'm Brittany Matulis, I'm a PhD student in Forest Management Stewardship. I'm doing my research on collaboration with the Forest Service and local stakeholders across the world.
My name is Wes. I'm a Natural Resource Management Program.
My name is Mark. I'm an anthropology master's student working.
I am Dave, also anthropology master's student in natural development specialization with a technical high school in Ecuador and Amazon, which is collecting goods and social capital.
Well, so I'm going to talk about the project I did for my fellowship with the CCC was to develop a model that we had actually been kind of developing for a number of years now, but we finally got, in fact, I officially got approval from the board of directors to formally move forward with this, so I needed to put some structure to the whole program. So the fellowship was, over the last year, was developing the model that I'm going to talk about here for we're really putting the final touches on it to where we can launch it. But just some background first, where this came from. I started working on the Pine Ridge Reservation around 1998, well, around 99 officially, and so I was also working with Village Earth at the time. I was first a volunteer there, and then went back to go to grad school at CSU, and was working with Dr. Pickering, which I'm assuming you're working with. And, so I started doing research on the Pine Ridge Reservation. At the same time, I was working with Village Earth and getting involved in trainings they've done, but really hadn't done much practical work on the ground, but had a lot of background in these trainings that Village Earth was doing. And so around 2001, while we were on the reservation, we put a call out. Kathy Pickering got a 5-year grant from the NSF to do a longitudinal household survey on Pine Ridge. And so we were going to be up there for a number of years. And so we put out a call and said, if any organizations can utilize this while we're here, we'll help with grant writing or organizational help or whatever we can do. And one group responded, and they were called they were organized by the tribe's housing authority, and they were organized to assist. There's cluster housing projects all across the reservation that the U.S. government built, and so they wanted help creating organizations in each of these cluster housing groups. And so I initially started working with these organizations, and through that we did a lot of planning and sort of visioning on where they wanted the reservation to look like and where they want their communities to look like. And at that time, I didn't really know much about Pine Ridge, and so I learned a lot through that process. And from that experience, we found out that people don't even want to be in those housing projects. They had no intention of wanting to improve them, because if they could, they would just move out and move on their own land. And that's, so around 2003, once that program's funding ran out, I was just working with them as a volunteer, but the program kind of dissolved. And that's when I got approval from Village Earth to work on that effort of helping families get on their own land and utilize it. And so we didn't have any funding for this initiative. We basically just, from the research, we were interviewing all these households, and I was talking to people all across the reservation. And we started to hear about people who were doing this, who had gotten control of their allotted lands. Most of the people on Pine Ridge have, that they inherited, somewhere around 200 acres or so. And people wanted to utilize that acre. A lot of people were living in cluster housing while their land was being leased out by non-tribal members and used for farming and ranching. So other people were making money on their land while they were living in housing projects. So they wanted to gain control of that. And so we identified a few families that were doing that, and just informally approached them and said, we want to work with you on this effort. And just kind of help you along the way and wherever we can. And a few families we started out with. One of those was the Red Cloud family. That was the first group. And of course, we didn't have any funding to say, like, okay, we're going to fund you to do this project. We just started out as partners in this. And eventually, we created a plan together, and they wanted to get, they got their land out of the government leasing system. They had started putting a fence up with some funding they got from some Europeans. But they wanted to, they needed to finish the fencing, and they needed to get animals out there and develop the water resources for the buffalo. And so we developed a plan together to do fundraising. And at that point we said, well, Village Earth, we decided, well, let's start Adopt a Buffalo program. That was an idea that Henry Red Cloud had. To, he had heard about the Heifer Project, where they buy goat for a family or a cow. And so we thought, well, we could do that with buffalo. And we helped them create, actually this is where Gil Reed first came into the pictures. We put together a brochure, and you know, this was a joint fundraising effort, and Village Earth said, well, you know, you can use our nonprofit status, and any money that you raise for this project will go into our account, and will be used just for this project. And then it came down to a point where people really got excited about this project. We were getting a lot of, you know, as soon as we partnered with this family, all these people from Europe started calling me, because they were saying, yeah, we've been watching this project for years, we've been wanting to fund them, but they really didn't have any, you know, they weren't communicating, they didn't, you know, there wasn't really any controls on funding, they couldn't get any kind of reports back, and it was just difficult. People wanted to support it, but they didn't have the real financial structure to do that. And so once we partnered with the family, they were able to solicit donations on their own. It just opened up a whole structure for them to receive donations.
And because you had a 501c3?
Yeah, because there was a 501c3. Also because we could communicate with email. I mean, at that time, no one really had email on the res. And, you know, so I could send photos to them, videos that they could then use to do fundraising. We helped them set up a website. And at that point I realized, you know, just the fact of having that partnership opened up all these opportunities for them to get resources. So that was a valuable service in itself, just providing that. What that's called in the nonprofit world is fiscal sponsorship, where an NGO partners with a non-incorporated organization, or it could be incorporated, and provides an umbrella. So basically, they use your nonprofit status to do fundraising. And then it got to the point where I was doing so much work, you know, communicating with donors and processing donations and sending thank you checks or thank you notes, that I approached the family and I said, hey, you know, Village Earth I could devote more of my time to this work if we were able to get paid from some of these donations. And that's when we agreed that Village Earth would keep a percentage of any of the donations that came. And they were totally excited about that because I could devote more time to fundraising and helping them out. But that really became the foundation for the whole affiliate model. And that became the model of how we work with other groups across Pine Ridge, is that we would partner with them. We wouldn't provide any guarantee of funding, or we wouldn't provide any, like, you know, grants. We would just say, you can use our nonprofit status. We'll help you sort of develop your organization, develop your identity as an organization, and then connect you with donors. But it was really, you know, the more especially in the last year, I realized like how unorganized that really was. It actually, it did open us up to some liability in some cases, that the work that I've done with the CC has helped clean up some of that. But that's the background of where this came. So the origins of this really go back to about 2002 and that work for Pine Ridge. But what we want to do is create a model that we could bring other organizations and use that same approach to supporting grassroots organizations around the world, and not have it be such a slow personal process where I have to go and get to know the group, and we can have a more proceduralized process, I guess. And what this tries to address in the international context, especially in the NGO world, is this paradox of the traditional funding of grassroots organizations. Generally, around the world, you know, NGOs often partner with local organizations, oftentimes we don't know this, and that's a big problem. But with that partnership, those are usually short-term, on average about 3 to 5 years. And that's usually how the funding cycles go. So an NGO will provide funding to a grassroots group or a community organization for somewhere around 3 to 5 years. The nature of that project is generally directed to the strategic priorities of the donors versus that of the local group. So the local, so international NGO, and I'm thinking like CARE International or Mercy Corps or IRC, these are huge aid organizations, or World Learning, or some of the conservation organizations. They'll have priorities like we want to protect, or we want to promote HIV AIDS awareness, or we want to create access to water, or we want to enhance food sovereignty. So these are priorities that come from the donors on the top. But right now what's really fashionable is climate change, responses to climate change or whatever. But that doesn't necessarily mean that that meshes with the priorities of those communities. And so oftentimes that those local community groups have their own priorities, but an NGO will approach them and say, hey, we've got funding for climate change or for HIV/AIDS awareness, and they'll partner with these local organizations to implement those projects. But if given the choice, those local organizations oftentimes would like to do something very different, more responsive to the needs of their communities. And that's what we're, you know, the sort of core philosophy here is that we believe local NGOs are going to be most responsive to local issues and local needs and local priorities, not international NGOs.
So David, does that mean we have much far fewer donors interested in what they're doing because their priorities are set by the organizations? Do you have a limited number of donors willing to go with you?
Not necessarily. When I say donors here, donors in terms of those NGOs, right? Because those NGOs become donors. Or what's happening more and more, which I put increasing the governments, is NGOs are increasingly becoming contractors for governments. So, you know, the majority of official development assistance out there, you know, funding from USAID, you know, AID isn't necessarily doing projects on their own anymore. They're subcontracting with international NGOs like CARE and Mercy Corps and International Rescue Committee. And I know that because we do training with these organizations and we partner with some large projects like that.
But I'm asking, are you swimming upstream against the donor world because their priorities are top down and your village needs?
Well, I think it's about showing donors that this is what the true needs are on the ground versus what donors are, or what NGOs are saying what the issues are. So that's the case we need to make, is that through this model that they're better able to connect with the grassroots and grassroots issues rather than what these large NGOs are determining what the issues are, or what's fashionable. The funding world is very fashion-based, very trend-based. So also people have noticed, I just read a book on how increasingly concentrated international funding is becoming in a few hotspots. So just as certain things like microcredit or climate change become these trend areas, so do certain geographic areas. And so, especially when, as governments are becoming more the funders of NGOs, NGOs are responding to the strategic priorities of governments and not where the need is at. And so what people are finding is that NGOs are becoming increasingly concentrated in a few key hotspots around the world. You know, like for the United States, the Horn of Africa is a big focus area because they're concerned about terrorism. And so they're pumping all this money into aid. But if you also look at the other hotspots, it's generally where oil is concentrated. So we did some consulting in Azerbaijan, and when I started that out, I was thinking, there were all these NGOs just swarming all around Azerbaijan, and I was like, what's going on here? And it's the Black Sea. The main priority there is trying to stabilize the region. facilitate the extraction of oil in opposition of the Russians trying to destabilize. So the traditional model often requires that local organizations comply with Western organizational models. So meeting with, complying with Western log frames and reporting standards and organizational boards of directors and this sort of thing in order to interface with these international NGOs or international government funders. They often frame the beneficiaries as the object and the NGO as the subject. So it's the people, the beneficiaries are the things that the NGO is doing, the NGO is doing the work. The NGOs are the ones making the change and doing the impact, and they're the ones who are being affected by that. When in actuality, the reality is that a lot of local organizations are doing that, and local leadership. But the NGO, the way funding models work is that you have to mask that. You have to, the NGO has to emphasize what they're doing on the ground to ensure that they're getting the funding and people aren't redirecting that directly to those grassroots groups. So NGOs are appropriating machines. They appropriate all the good things that are going on the ground because try to justify that by saying, well, this is how we have to be funded. We have to show that we have to promote our organization in order to ensure that we can continue funding grassroots groups. Organizational liability increases with greater size and decentralization. So even though there's a greater call for decentralization among NGOs around the world, the main paradox is the liability increase. So as a group, as an NGO pushes more of that on the local communities, their liability increases. And that's why, and as their tentacles extend around the world, liability increases, so they need to maintain greater and greater control. And that's it's a structural issue within NGOs. I'll talk about that in a little bit. Builds resource networks around the NGO and not the indigenous or local organization. That's what I was saying about the appropriating machines, that they're the ones that are making, even though they may espouse that they want to build the capacity of local organizations, how is that possible if they are directing all the donations and grants and recognition to their organization and not the local organization? Any questions on any of those before I move on? So some of the typical models of NGO expansion is, has anybody read that book, The Spider and the Starfish? It's a contrasting between different organizational models. A starfish is a decentralized model that is more resistant and more resilient to change, where a spider is sort of the traditional model of NGO growth, where an NGO extends its tentacles around the world and has branch offices, and those branch offices are accountable to a national office, and then to the office in D.C. or in London or wherever it's at. Another popular model has been the chapter model, in that they're semi-autonomous, but they share an organizational identity. So it does prevent some limitations on local groups from forming their own identity separate from the national or the international NGO. And I think this is probably one important. Well, a hybrid between the spider and the chapter has been what most NGOs, when they talk about decentralization, have been doing, in that they've been often creating local boards of directors that can be take on some of that accountability. But they still share the organizational identity of the central organization. And then the affiliate. And this is the model that we've been trying to develop. And that's where you have autonomous affiliates, autonomous organizations with their own organizational identity, But partnering with you in a support role, or in a partnership role. And it's not a exclusive relationship. So some of the features of that, this model that we've been working on. So it's based around long-term fiscal sponsorship. So building a long-term relationship with organizations. So you really understand what's going on the ground, building trust with people, not about control, but about having trust to where you can relinquish control, and have a faith in that you're both operating on the same sort of guiding philosophies. Built on relationship and trust, respect, and reciprocity. Recognizing local indigenous forms of organization. So the beauty of the affiliate model is that we can partner with organizations, especially indigenous organizations that may have completely different organizational structures than what we're used to in the West. In fact, on the Pine Ridge Reservation, you know, with the first family we started working with, their model was, we're all going to be, it was a collection of brothers and sisters and their families, and they had the grandmother as the sort of the chair. And if she, you know, they would decide by consensus, and then she ultimately would have to approve, make the final approval. But another group we work on, they have their, that we're also working with on Pine Ridge, they're working off a traditional model of organization where they're basing it around the distinct Lakota roles of the male and the female and elders. So progressively, the elders, the oldest male has sort of the final say, and then they progressively go down. But they also consult with, you know, in ceremony for decision making. So, I mean, this is completely, you know, does not comply with the Western model of organization.
Do you run into problems that we would define as corrupt? Is that difficult? In Africa, there's a lot of talk about corruption.
Yeah, you know, in fact, we had a situation with a group that was working on gardening, and we were providing a short-term project sort of support for them on Pine Ridge, and that did happen. Some funds got mismanaged, and we had a lot of talks early on of how funds would be managed, and they said, well, we want to do this, we want to have control over the funds. So basically, we would disperse, that we would receive the grant and then disperse it in a lump sum to them versus paying for directly for to vendors. And that happened. Some funds got mismanaged. But in the end, they wrote a letter to the foundation that gave the grant and explained the whole situation and how us allowing them that freedom allowed them to figure out their organization structure and figure out where things aren't working. And the Bush Foundation wrote us back and we're like, we're applauding us for having that faith. They were more concerned about developing this organizational model than actually the garden project. So allowing that autonomy was important. And they acknowledged that with us and with the funding. So it encourages the autonomy of organization. It builds identity and support network around the grassroots organization. So in this model, we're trying to de-emphasize the role of villager and put the grassroots organization in the forefront. So we're serving as sort of a fiscal supporter, but not in the forefront. We're not trying to appropriate the good work that they're doing on the ground. We're trying to put them in the front and say, look at what the Knife Chief Buffalo Project has done. Look what the Guarani Defense Fund has done, defense organization. And put them in the front and connect the donors directly to them. Because of the fiscal relationship, the funding goes through us and then to them, but the donor sees that organization as the one that's implemented, as the subject, as, and partly the object because they're from that community. So we've kind of, through this process, have broken it out into three distinct relationships that we would have with the community group. So the local NGO capacity building program. So these are the three sort of models that came out of this research I've been doing with through the CCC, with support from the CCC. That these are the different actors, that you have an autonomous grassroots organization, and that can be an incorporated organization, as an association, or as a private business even, or even as an individual. It really doesn't matter. It can have an organizational structure based off a Western model or completely different. But we do ask that the groups identify how they make decisions. I think that's the basic description that we try to look for, is how do you make decisions as a group? And how do you know? So that way we know when a decision has been made. And it's not just someone calling up and saying, hey, release the funds. We need to know that they have some way of making decisions together, and when a decision is legitimate in the end. So the Village Earth Foreign NGO Affiliate, so a foreign-based grassroots support organization with separate legal existence from Village Earth. So that would be like a, in this case, these are the groups we're working with: Empowering Youth Cambodia, Village Care Initiative Sierra Leone, SGDI India, and Hensara in Colombia. And these are our local NGOs run by nationals in most cases, and who are supporting local grassroots organizations. And then what we do is Village Earth provides U.S. fiscal sponsorship. And so what that does is it allows that local NGO to receive funding from U.S. donors, because U.S. donors can receive a tax deduction for it, and they can also solicit grants and funding. Another, an important aspect of this model, or I guess an opportunity that we're trying to take advantage of that exists now that didn't exist prior, is the internet. Is that now it's possible for an organization in Sierra Leone or in Colombia to connect directly with donors through things like Facebook and Twitter, email. A group can now access those donors. And so we're trying to build those bridges of access directly to donors versus having this intermediary. But we provide that fiscal sponsorship so donors can have the accountability they need. And then also, assurance that funds are being used for that intended purpose and that they're going to that organization and that they get a tax deduction, which is helpful. And a lot of foundations have to give to a nonprofit. So if you're designated as a foundation, you have to give your funding to a registered 501c3 organization. And then through that, so we help connect to individual donors, grants, and then also help connect them to advocacy support and technical support and training that may come directly from us, or we may help connect them to other third-party groups that will provide that sort of training. So our role is really becoming not, I think the most distinct part about this from a traditional development organization is that we're no longer operational in the field. That we're not doing the work on the ground. We're supporting local organizations to do that, but providing them access to resources in the United States and in Europe, and then connecting them with the resources in the U.S., also with technical training, advocacy support, that sort of thing. Any questions about that? So the next model, which we're calling the Global Linkages Program, is where we partner with a US-based grassroots support organization with separate legal existence from Village Earth, who then is supporting autonomous grassroots organizations. And this could be a US-based NGO, could be a US-based association, or even a couple individuals who are partnering with a grassroots group. And we identify this as an important relationship because, in fact, we see this a lot in our work, is that a lot of times you have an individual or two who have a relationship with a group or a project in some other country, but don't have a formal way to connect that group to resources. And so we can provide a fiscal relationship so they can basically operate as if they're an NGO, a nonprofit in the US, and receive donations and grants, which can then go to support that grassroots group. And I think this model is especially helpful for situations where you have a very unformed grassroots organization. So if you have a few individuals who are partnering with communities or grassroots groups, this allows them to still work in a flexible way with those groups while being able to access resources. And then lastly, the regional mobilization initiatives. So these are projects like Pine Ridge or our Peru project, where it's actually a villager and staff who are working with numerous grassroots groups or individuals across an entire region. And sort of this could also be seen as sort of an initial phase where you're just starting to identify groups that exist in a region and helping form some sort of cohesion that can possibly later form into an organization. But sometimes an organization isn't always needed. Maybe it's just to respond to a short-term situation. But this allows those grassroots groups to connect to resources without having to formalize too quickly. And I think that's a key thing in all of these relationships is organizations don't, you know, in order to access resources, don't have to formalize before it's necessary. Sometimes that formalization process, which I mean, you know, identifying a board of directors and coming up with bylaws and all the things you need to get legally recognized, sometimes in that process can destroy an organization. Because maybe in the initial phases it's still a fluid organization, they haven't identified leadership, and maybe that's not even needed at that point. So I think all of these sort of bridge that gap between informality and formality and provides an intermediate structure that informal groups can still access resources. And often it's informal groups that have the most voluntary energy that actually is most impactful. Where after an organization gets established for several years and funding becomes more reliable, it's easy for that voluntary energy to disappear and become replaced with more of a drive for careers or money. So we find, you know, through the CCC's grant, we were able to get the framework of this set up, and in July, we got this approved by the board of directors of Build Earth, and quickly we brought on some new organizations. So we brought on Earth Teepee, which is a group on Pine Ridge that is working on sustainable housing and permaculture. Hensida, which we just brought on 2 weeks ago. They're a group working on indigenous rights issues in Colombia. Living Roots, they're actually a group that came out of CSU, and they're came out of the GSSC program. So they're working with traditional artisans in Mexico. Maloca is a group that's working with the Guarani in Ecuador, and they're helping them with protecting their territory against oil extraction and illegal logging. And Village Care Initiatives in Sierra Leone. And they're working on they're working a lot with orphans from the conflict that they've had over the years. So trying to develop self-sufficiency projects for orphans and orphanages. And the others were projects, a lot of these, like Buffalo Hump Sanctuary, Knife Chief, Lakota Buffalo Caretakers, and Lakota Lands Recovery Project, Unity TOH Pride Project, are all things that have come out of that, or all projects that have come out of that work over the years on Pine Ridge. And it's sort of how we see is how this can work across the region. Of, you know, me as the sort of external activator is what we call that, working with these various informal and formal organizations to help bridge them, to help them access resources, but not doing that work ourselves, not being the ones that are going and implementing this, helping them form and develop their own identities. Yeah?
Do you generally initiate the contact, or do they come to you?
Yes, they come to us, generally. In the case, except for, you know, Buffalo Hump Sanctuary, that's what the Red Cloud Project is called. And we initially just met informally, and then they invited us back to do a planning meeting just to kind of explore how we can partner with them. But yeah, generally all of them have been asked for our support.
Have they found out about them?
Well, we're online. But you know, in a lot of like Pine Ridge, people just hear about the work we're doing and approach us.
But Sierra Leone, we found it.
Sierra Leone, like that's the one example where he just found us on the internet, just searching for us. You know, searching for training and capacity support. And we started this discussion over the phone. And we have an application process, so that was part of this, is developing a whole process for bringing in. See, the IRS, the notion of fiscal sponsorship is a gray area with the IRS. They recognize it, yet there's no formal ruling. But there are certain procedures you have to follow for it to be legitimate. And one of those is that the local organization has to, or the sponsee has to apply to the sponsor. And there has to be an approval process. It has to be approved at the board of directors level. So as the executive director, I can't approve that relationship. And there's various levels of liability that you take on in taking on. All the way from it being considered an internal project where you assume organizationally all the liability, to being more of how we've structured it where the organization remains autonomous and they're liable for their own, you know, if through the funding they receive through this relationship, if they build a bridge and that bridge collapses, they assume the liability. And that's feature which allows us to be hands-off, that we can help them with the support, we can help them raise funds, but these, you know, they're responsible ultimately on how they use those funds on the ground.
Related to that, who handles reporting and monitoring on these projects? I gather it's probably largely on them, but do you help with information transfer between organizations, between donors and...
Yeah, the other responsibility we have as fiscal sponsor is to ensure that funds were used as the donor intended. So there is that level of control that we need to ensure that, you know, if a donor says this is going to go to this project for defensive forest, then it needs to be used for that, and we need to show that we're verifying that that's actually the case. But we're not deciding those priorities ahead of time. We're letting the group to identify their priorities and then help them find resources to fund them.
As you mentioned, there tend to be in the funding world these hotspots of thematic and geographic priorities. You obviously have one hotspot, which is Pine Ridge, and then you have a rather eclectic group of other areas you're helping around the world that, as you mentioned earlier, a lot of them just come to you and found you online. But is the relationship purely financial, of serving as an umbilical cord to funding, or with this array of associates, are you providing technical assistance and capacity building expertise and institutional strengthening support on the ground, are either through national affiliates or through your own staff base over?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's set up as a financial relationship, as a, you know, structurally. But beyond that, we provide, you know, training, we provide technical support, helping them to develop the capacity to do fundraising. But like in the case of Pine Ridge, you know, with an example of how that would play out is, through that work, I was working with a number of independent buffalo ranchers. And it came to a point where they wanted to start accessing the markets. They wanted to start selling that buffalo. And so our role was helping serve as an intermediary, bring those buffalo caretakers together. And they formed a cooperative. We helped them with developing a label. We helped them with the health code inspections and getting all set up to do marketing. We helped set up an LLC in Fort Collins that would serve as a distributor for that buffalo meat. So it can range, you know, that level of support, you know, all the way to just, in the case of Cambodia, the director of that project attended our training. We have a 2-week training that we offer. He came to that and then went back to Cambodia and started up this organization. And so he had that initial, you know, spark from that training. And then, but he's been pretty independent. So he's been able to develop that pretty autonomously. Occasionally we provide, you know, some advice or, you know, consulting here and there. But and then of course the advocacy support too, I think is something, you know, one of the reasons Tensoro was so interested in partnering with us is because they work with a lot of indigenous leaders whose lives are threatened by, you know, groups like the FARC, and what they want to do is provide international, you know, so our partnering with them raises the status of these leaders and provides an international, you know, so if one of these leaders disappears, we can raise a stink in the U.S. Throughout the embassy, and, you know, make those broader connections in that sense. Same with Maloka, that's more of a lot of advocacy.
You mentioned the courses too, because that's a lot of work.
Yeah, so we're, I think, you know, initially we were setting up this sort of fiscal model, but our work now is really, and this is one thing Gail Marie is helping with us do, is develop this. We're trying to build like an e-learning network, somewhat similar to what the CCC has done, where the affiliates there can be a lot of cross-fertilization going on. So we're trying to build connections between the affiliates so they can learn what each other's doing. We can help them develop. Like for instance, in 2 weeks, one of the groups on Pine Ridge is gonna do a fundraising training that they're gonna present to all the other affiliates, just to show how this group has been particularly successful in using the internet, Facebook to raise funds. And so they're gonna do a little webinar that we're gonna do online, and they're gonna train the other affiliates. So we're trying to, you know, use this to build these lateral connections among organizations, not just between us. But then we also offer, we have a certificate program, and through CSU, through continuing ed, we have about 15 different courses that we offer online. They're non-credit, but so I see that as that those courses are available to our participants, but also I'd like our participants, you know, when someone develops an innovative strategy, that they can become trainers through that online program, because it's really a practitioner-based program and not so much focused on students.
Who is wondering if you have any issues about like equity or kind of competition between all your affiliates? Because like if a donor goes to the website, the villager, and they're trying to pick one of these organizations to donate to, but maybe Buffalo Home has been around for a while, so they have a beautiful website and some of the other ones don't, and people are more attracted, you know, marketing's better for the Buffalo Homes. So some of the other ones never get anybody to donate to them. Do you have like a statement where you say these affiliates need more help than other ones? Or do you redirect donors because some sanctuaries are getting more funding or some of the affiliates are getting more funding than other ones?
Yeah, that's an issue. You know, as we bring on more groups, that is becoming more of an issue. And I think especially for Pine Ridge, because they're also clustered in one geographic area. And that has happened. You know, we were doing a fundraiser for a youth center this summer, and Earth TV put off the start of their fundraising campaign until the other one was done, because they didn't want to overlap. But, you know, they've been pretty cooperative at this point, but I do recognize that as being a possible source of conflict. But we are trying to coordinate the timing, and we're also trying to figure out, because Village Earth, you know, we're trying to figure out how we sustain ourselves among also affiliates sustaining themselves. And so how much work do we put into promoting affiliates versus Village Earth itself? I think eventually we'd like it to just be all affiliates, at least I would, and just promoting them and Village Earth totally getting in the background. But until we reach that critical mass, it's not going to happen right away.
So if you were to kind of compare outcomes from the traditional model and then your model, is there a clear difference in development outcomes? And secondly, do you see public sector aid moving towards these more affiliate-based models?
Well, to answer your second question first, I do. In fact, we had a conference call with the Mott Foundation, and this, you know, that was a big focus of theirs, is sort of these new innovative modes of philanthropy, because I think people are recognizing that, you know, the big international NGOs are becoming too big, and they're not as dynamic and flexible. And, at the same time, you have this recognition that there's all these grassroots organizations around the world, and they're With especially facilitated by the internet, they have the ability to connect to donors. You know, you no longer need that intermediary, but they can connect, you know, to donors directly if the structure is there for that. And your first question,
outcomes.
In terms of, you know, I would say this model evolved in conjunction with our trainings. And really out of a response to our trainings, because, you know, we would always have people say, well, this training's great, but how do I do this within my organization? You know, I have a 3-year timeline. How am I supposed to truly support the community in this, you know, in a long-term solidarity if we have a 3-year timeline, if our funding's gonna run out, if I can't make promises to that community? So we see the value of having a local organization. Local organizations have a long-term commitment. They're not going anywhere. You know, they're directly affected by the issues. So they're much better suited to doing this kind of work than an international NGO staffed by expats, because those expats are gonna leave, and or they're gonna be restationed, or when the funding runs out, they're gonna move somewhere else. So that's key to the key ingredient in any of this kind of work is trust. And trust isn't something developed overnight. It's something that takes a long time. And we've learned that, you know, with 10 plus years on Pine Ridge, you know, I'm just starting to make contacts with some people that, you know, are like opening up new doors and building the trust that people are willing to take a risk. You talk a little bit about the protocol for caretakers cooperative with helping them get their products to market, but I'm wondering how involved you are with them or with other affiliates in, you know, not just that connection between donors and organizations, but then in some cases organizations to markets as a product center, and how that works compared to the, you know, donor organization relationship, what that process is going to be. How involved you are, say, in the caregiver cooperative example with
actually connecting the cells more easily.
Yeah, I mean, it's, of course, I've had to, I used to be almost exclusively involved in the work on Pine Ridge, and so I, you know, as I've become director, I've had to back off a lot, and I see that as being a good development, and that it's forced me to think about how we can create these networks of support without being directly involved, because that's just not sustainable. You know, after being on Pine Ridge, working there for 10 years, and now I have a family, and you know, we have other tensions that don't allow us to be there, and so we really need to emphasize on building local capacity. So I think the shift has been trying to de-emphasize our role and put more emphasis on building capacity. I don't know if that answered your question now.
Yeah.
Survey the first year, it's embarrassing because it was just so out from left field. But what we did is over the years, you know, as I was doing these workshops, as we were interacting with the community, that survey became more and more refined every year we administer. And so we started to get more and more issues to where by the fourth and fifth, I think she's gone up to sixth year, but by the fifth year, it was really starting to get to key issues, which I was, you know, like, so we learned, like, in those workshops that land was a big issue and people wanted to use land. So we started putting that data in the surveys, and then I was able to use that for grant writing and to support these projects. So we also, you know, took that same data and used it to challenge the federal census. So the housing authority came to us and said, hey, our numbers are way low on the census, the 2000 census, and could you help us do a challenge? And so we used the data from that census to challenge the federal census, and we won that, and that resulted in like $1.5 million a year more for, you know, every year after that. So you can use that.
Have, like, the involvement of the community group while you're doing and deciding your research.
You know, if I would have done it again, I would have spent the whole first year just doing community workshops like we're doing, and spend more time in the upfront, zeroing in on what the core issues were, rather than having a lot of questions that were just like way from left field.
Was your thesis work pretty well in the umbrella of Kathy's work?
Her survey was looking at time allocation, social networks, and informal economy. And she was like, you take the social network side. And I pretty much could develop that whole aspect. But then over that, like, it just, she didn't, you know, she was open to modifying it a lot, which was a good thing. I think, are we?
Yep. One more question, otherwise we'll wrap it up here.
So being flexible, I mean, and she was, I think she had to consult a lot with, I know we had to consult a lot with human subjects and the National Science Foundation, but you know, in the end, it made that, the data from that really relevant, and it's continually being used by programs up there. So people have, you know, in a place like that where the reservation is almost 90% grant-driven. You know, most of the money that comes on, 90% comes from federal grants. And so they need data to write grants and to make those, you know, to demonstrate where they need resources and funding. So that's been a huge value.
Oh.
So any other questions? One more? Mm-hmm. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, David.